Want to make sure your names are on them. Make your final guesses. And when you're set, send them this away. There's no reason to leave anything blank. Oh, okay. I don't take off for wrong answers. So, in general, guess. Okay, so you know the exam's in 6 days. Usually I schedule a time outside of class that you can ask questions. So usually that's the day before or the day before the day before, you know, kind of before dinner or after dinner. And we usually establish that time by voting. And I don't know if you know your schedules well enough that you want to vote today or you want to vote on Monday. Monday, okay. So the one time that's X'd out is 4 p.m. on Tuesday because I'll be in lab. Any of those times otherwise will be okay. Say again? So the test is 6 days from today. Today's Thursday, so it's Wednesday.
Next Wednesday.
Yep. All the test days are in the syllabus, so you can plan ahead there.
How big are the tests?
How big? So let me kind of answer maybe the different sort of question, and that is what's the best way of studying for the test? And I think it'll answer that question too. All tests are online. So you can see exactly the sort of tests that you will face by looking at last year's test for this course or last year's test for the 211 course. And what I think the best way to study for it is to actually work that test, write down answers, and then bring them in to me sometime, and we can go over them together, and I can tell you what's right and what's wrong about your answers. So I'm not sure how much I should stress. Your test will not be identical to those tests, but I claim afterwards you will agree that there is a lot of similarity. And certainly a good number of questions will exactly repeat. And the one question you know for sure is going to be there is the culmination exam, the culmination quiz problem. So the upshot, if you look at the structure of those exams, there's 20 true and false, 15 short answer, and 5 10-point essay questions for 40 questions total. Questions? So the homework, I hope will be a little bit clearer after today's class, is going to be the plot, the distance that planets are from the sun versus how long it takes them to go around. The tricky part is actually the other side of this. There may be two tricky parts. One tricky part is the other side of this. If you look at these scales, they're kind of funny, right? So the other scale went 10, 20, 30, 40. This scale goes 1, 10, 100. Or 0.1, 1, 10. So those are called logarithmic scales. And if you count carefully the number of tick marks between here and there, you'll find there are 8 tick marks, which is exactly what you need for those tick marks to be 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Right, so for example, this point here is going to be 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, and then we're at 100. And then we'd be at 200, 300, 400, and so it goes.
I have an unrelated question on the definition of horizon. It says it's a great circle midway between the infinite. How is the horizon a great circle? Wouldn't it be a small circle?
No, it's a great circle. So usually the way we think about this is that we are the center of this sphere, and the horizon is going right through us, right? The plane that is the horizon is going right through us. And any plane that goes right through the center of the sphere will be a great circle.
Okay, but like if I'm standing right here, zenith is straight up there, maybe straight down there.
And so just as so you can think about zenith and nadir as being like poles, and the equator is a great circle that goes around it. So same thing for the horizon. It's perpendicular to both zenith and nadir, and so it's a great circle that's the equivalent of the celestial equator.
So if I'm standing on the North Pole, I can see the celestial equator from all corners, and that's the horizon. Because I thought a great circle had to be the biggest possible circle around.
Yeah, and the horizon is the biggest possible circle.
So standing at the North Pole, you can see the equator?
Yes, yep. So the equator would be your horizon. And if we wanted to talk a little bit of details, you can actually see a little bit below the horizon because of atmospheric refraction. But mathematically, the celestial equator would be your horizon at the North Pole.
Okay.
You might remember we talked about this in the context of 6 months of darkness and 6 hours of, 6 months of darkness. So during a year, all of this time, if you're right at the North Pole, the sun would be above the horizon. So over 6 months, it would gradually spiral up till it was making a 23.5 degree circle above the horizon and then circle down. And we'd be followed by 6 months of darkness when the sun is below the celestial equator and hence below the horizon. More questions? Nope, I guess it was a stretch. Maybe I'll add about the exam. Often I'm asked, what will it cover? So we've covered 4 chapters of the book, and sometimes it's not going to be an exact match. But actually, I think this time it will be a pretty good match to what will be on the exam. And the old exams may not hit the same spots that we did, but I think, in fact, the old exams will hit pretty much where we hit. We can see where we are on Monday. Well, I'm not sure what that would be, but the answer would, I'm tempted to say, no, if we didn't talk about it in class, it won't be on the exam. I'm pretty tempted to say that, but I worry because I can't think of anything important that we haven't talked about. So if you have some examples of some relatively big piece of the book that you don't think we talked about, then maybe we should talk. We got to know that profs' view of their own exams is distorted, right? So quote unquote, I only cover the important stuff. Right? So you know how that works. So kind of an example of that is last time we were working on this list of people, and all of those people are named in our book. But I told you in terms of exam, these are the names you need to be familiar. Plato and Aristotle, you should have been familiar with before you stepped into this classroom. And Ptolemy, which may be a new name for you, is the guy who kind of wrote the book on the geocentric model. So Eudoxus, student of Plato. Plato had kind of commented in one of his dialogues that he expects that the universe should be perfectly mathematical and in all regards, the most perfect possible way, and hence circles. And Eudoxus is the guy who kind of worked that out, not in excruciating detail, but in fair detail about how a series of spheres could cause the kind of funny motions that we talked about last time. And almost undoubtedly, Plato was dealing with previous knowledge, describing how the planets moved. So Aristotle is the big man, right? He's the start of just about every academic discipline, and he wrote about astronomy just like lots of other things. And he wrote out the details and the overriding explanation for why we expect it to work that way. So one of the problems that people who wanted to overthrow the system faced is that Aristotle's theory was not just a theory of astronomy, it was a theory about everything. And so there was an automatic reluctance to throw out part of Aristotle and hang on to the pieces of Aristotle that people like. So it was relatively hard to dislodge this theory because it was part of an overarching theory of pretty much everything. So the basic idea of Aristotle is that the places that are close to the Earth are subject to decay. They're made out of kind of lousy elements, earth, air, water, and fire, which have natural places. So the earth stuff wants to fall to the center of the earth, and so we have this rocky body that is the center of the universe, and we have the other elements kind of arrayed around them. But if we get far enough away from the earth, we're not subject to decay, and we're made out of different elements, the quintessence, the fifth element, and that's perfect. It doesn't weigh anything, it wants to go in circles, and so that's why the celestial objects move in circles, because they're made of the quintessence. And they can whiz around for nothing, because they don't have any mass. They're not subject to the constraints that we have here on Earth. So Aristarchus is the guy who's usually most quoted for trying to trying to foster the heliocentric model, the model you learned about in grade school, where everything's going around the sun. And basically the explanation for how Aristarchus figured that is he used geometry to figure the sizes of the planetary objects, and he came to the conclusion that the sun was way bigger. And he kind of didn't buy this argument of Aristotle that that the heavens were that radically different from the earth, and kind of naturally thinking you would think that the small stuff would go around the big stuff as opposed to vice versa. And mathematically, if you just change your definition of what's going around what, if you keep with circles, but instead of having the earth being the center, if you make the sun being in the center, you can still have circles and circles, and you get it actually exactly the same mathematical predictions as to where the planets are going to be. I'm not sure we talked about we talked briefly about knowing the size of the Earth. So Aristotle, Plato, who knows when the first people figured out that the Earth was a sphere. Aristotle has lots of classical arguments for the Earth being a sphere. Eratosthenes was kind of the first person to get an accurate measurement for the size of the sphere. And the way you do that is pretty simple. You just take two locations on the Earth, and if you know the difference in latitude and you know the distance between these two cities, then you can just set up a proportion. So let's say we take two cities that are 10 degrees apart, and we know the distance between those cities is 500 stadia, then we can just set up a proportion between the 500 stadia and the 10 degrees and the full circumference of the Earth divided by 360 degrees. So the obvious way to find the latitude of places for us, of course, is to just look at how far the North Celestial Pole is above the horizon, right? So you can measure that in one city, you can measure it in another city, and you can find the differences in latitude. You might remember that at this time, Polaris wasn't a pole star. There wasn't a convenient pole star. So actually, exactly what Eratosthenes did was he used the sun as his standard point. So by looking at the change in the culmination altitude of the sun, you know that that depends on altitude from the culmination question, he could figure out the size of the Earth. So I guess I would say yes or no. So if we have a city over here and over here, then we don't want this distance. We want the actual distance that would be north-south. And he actually did pick two cities which were pretty much north-south. And I actually talked about stadia because that's what we have. He, of course, didn't measure things in meters. Kind of the standard unit is a stadium. And I think I told you that this was considered a particularly accurate measurement of the circumference of the Earth. And that is to say that we know for sure that his change in latitudes was correct, because we know where those cities are today. They haven't changed. But we don't know the size of a stadia. So people actually go measure stadiums and they try and figure out what the size of a stadium is. So there is some debate about what exactly a stadia was, but the overall idea is perfect. And he certainly, if he had an idea of what a stadia was, that if he was accurate in his distance estimate between the two cities and stadia, then he was accurate in his within 1% of his distance circumference of the Earth. And I think I commented that actually Ptolemy, the last guy on the list, got the diameter of the Earth wrong, and that was kind of the basis of Columbus's idea that it was a short distance to China if you actually sailed west as opposed to east. Everyone knew that the Earth was a sphere, no danger of coming off of it, but the size was in dispute. And Ptolemy, as we'll learn, is the guy who wrote the book on astronomy and geography. So his view was probably overwhelmingly accepted at the time. Okay, Hipparchus. So Hipparchus is really the first guy who maybe was a professional astronomer. That might be an overstatement, but he measured lots of things with extraordinarily good accuracy. So for example, he repeated the measurements of Aristarchus that gave the rough size of the sun and the moon with greater accuracy. He had very accurate measurements of the time it takes for the sun to go, well, for the sun to complete its path on the ecliptic and for the moon to go around on its orbit. He's the guy who uncovered precession, right, the slow motion of the poles. So he did lots of very accurate measurements that in fact Ptolemy then wrote up in his book way later. So a lot of the actual work of astronomy that Ptolemy is going to write about, the actual measurements were done by Hipparchus. And unfortunately, we don't have any surviving works of Hipparchus. So the only reason we know much about Hipparchus is Ptolemy says, I'm taking these measurements from Hipparchus. If you don't like the magnitude system, which goes backwards, right? So smaller numbers are brighter. That's kind of due to Hipparchus, or at least that was what was in his star catalog. He had a list of like 1,000 stars, and he had to rank them according to how bright they were. So first star catalog that used right ascension and declination and recorded the magnitudes of those stars, all of that due to Hipparchus. Okay, so Ptolemy. So Ptolemy wrote the book, which became known as the Greatest, which is the Almanac in Arabic, that we've talked about lots of times, right? So the overall model is this kind of jury-rigged system where we have circles within circles. Yeah, where's a nice picture of this? Oh, here it is. So to make these loop-de-loops, the plan is to have the center of the epicycle move at more or less a uniform rate and have the planet going around in a circle around that. And the loop-de-loops are necessary in order to make these retrograde motions that are, in fact, observed. Kind of the detail that Ptolemy records, I don't know if he came up with this or not, is this idea of the equant. So you remember that the equant is the point about which rotation is uniform, right? So you can think about kind of a meter stick going out from the equant, going at a constant rate. So as a result, the planet is going to be going relatively slow here, where it's far from the Earth. It's nice to have a name for the point that's far from the Earth, which is apogee. And it's going to be moving fast when it's far out on that meter stick. Nice to have a name for the case where it's close to the Earth, and that's called perigee. Right, so apogee is when a planet is far from the Earth. Perigee is when a planet is close to the Earth. And we get this very accurate, pretty accurate, representation of how the planets move based on this sort of formula. So Ptolemy works out the set of deference and epicycles that are necessary for all the planets to match the motion that has been observed by Hipparchus and people going back even further. You know, so he gives you many significant digits as to how fast this epicycle is going to be moving. Okay, questions?
What is exactly the planet rotating around
in the center? So That's going to turn out to be an objection. If we go back to Plato, the whole object was to have things moving in perfect circles, but there's nothing perfect about this anymore, right? Because the center of the circle, there's nothing. And if we believe Aristotle, there's quintessence there anyway, right? So here's the Earth, it's not at the center. And the idea is to have uniform circular motion. Well, it's not uniform about the center, it's uniform about the equant. But in order to make the model work, Ptolemy is kind of forced into doing this. If you try and put the Earth at the center, if you try and put the spot that you get uniform measurement about at the center, it doesn't work as well. So this is what works, and they hit upon it, and it's not so they're just writing that this is what works, and a interesting question is whether they believe that that was really what was happening. To us, this seems oddly mechanistic. And we could imagine using this sort of mechanism to make calculations, but maybe not believing that literally this planet was on some circle that was going around another circle. And we kind of had no way of knowing whether those astronomers literally believed the system or whether they just used the system to say phenomena is the name for that process, as a way of kind of summarizing a lot of astronomical observations. More questions? Okay, so we've talked about the ancients, and this setup was, you know, believed for 1,500 years, for a long period of time. And the outline of chapter 4 is to figure out how people gave up on this story. And it's not as easy as you might think. So, for example, you might know that the Catholic Church was continuing to believe the geocentric model into the 1800s. And the reason they were believing it is not because they were crazy, but because there wasn't really strong numerical evidence to show that the geocentric model was wrong. So the idea behind that is that a lot of what's going on here is not based on precise observation proving that the sun wasn't moving, but instead on philosophical differences with Aristotle. Not liking what Aristotle was saying and therefore changing his system. So the guy who is usually credited with this whole idea is Copernicus. So this whole process of throwing out the geocentric system and adopting the heliocentric system, it's often called the Copernican Revolution. So literally on his deathbed, Copernicus published this book which proclaimed this new system of how the system of the world worked. So what was the basis of Copernicus's decision? Was it based on the fact that the old system didn't work? No, it wasn't. His system, since it was still based on circles, didn't work any better than the Ptolemaic system. It wasn't perfect, it was just close. So why give up this system for another system? Well, it turns out that Copernicus's concern was exactly the concern you mentioned. He didn't like this equant. It didn't make any sense to him that things were uniform about this point. So his whole system was trying to quote-unquote simplify this system by not using the equant. So he was still using epicycles and cycles. He was using them around the sun, but actually in his system the sun wasn't at the center either. The sun was off-center. He needed the sun to be off-center in order to match the observations, but he couldn't match them perfectly even by putting the sun off-center. Okay, so it's not that things became obviously clear that the sun wasn't moving with Copernicus. It wasn't. Copernicus's model was in terms of its predictions of planetary locations, it was just as good / just as bad as the old system. And his reason for it wasn't that it works better, It was that it was more philosophically pleasing. So kind of another piece that probably played a role for Copernicus is that regardless of the mass of the sun is certainly the principal object, right? It's the object that we absolutely depend on. And it kind of makes more sense to put the sun at the center as opposed to the earth. So occasionally Copernicus is accused of elevating, literally elevating the earth. And of course, it's not really the case, right? The earth was a cesspool in the old system too, right? It was where the junk had collected. It wasn't a particularly good or perfect place, going back to Aristotle. Okay, so Copernicus writes a book about how the system works, but there's really, you've got the Ptolemaic system and you've got Copernicus system, and there isn't a good way to decide between them, except kind of personal prejudice. Do you like the equant or do you not like the equant? Do you think that the sun is the important thing and belongs in the center or not? Those are all arguable points. So what we'd like to have is some sort of real reason to prefer one system over the other. And lots of these names I hope you're already familiar with, but the name that I bet you're least familiar with is Tycho. And Tycho really deserves a huge amount of credit, even though he was not a nice guy. So what Tycho did is he was aware of Copernicus' work. He actually didn't believe Copernicus' work. He had his own system of the universe, which, I don't know, may sound kind of crazy to you. Basically, the way he set it up is that the Earth was still the center of the universe, and the sun was going around the Earth, but the other planets were going around the sun. So it's kind of exactly our system where you've just declared the sun to be moving as opposed to be stationary. So this Tychonic system is what he believed. He knew he didn't have any good reason to believe it. So what he set out to do is to make very accurate, the best observations that had ever been made. So before, people had probably been working kind of episodically. They hadn't been taking observations every day. They hadn't been using the maximum possible accuracy. So for 20 years, Tycho collected data on the exact location as best as he could estimate it with eye, because the telescope hadn't been invented yet. So as best as he could estimate the positions of all of the planets over those 20 years. So this is kind of where the sad truth comes in. I said Tycho did this. What Tycho did is have a bunch of slaves do it. So he was on this island Haven that was outside of Copenhagen. And in this kind of dreary island is where he had people making all of these observations. And he didn't actually finance it. It was financed by the king. But he oversaw all of this data collection. And then he actually had a fall. The king changed. He had a falling out with the new king. And so he left Denmark. And he had this bunch of data that had been collected, literally many volumes of data that had been collected. And what he did is he hired somebody to analyze that data. He was pretty old at this point. He gave most of the data to his son, and he gave the data for the planet Mars to Kepler and had Kepler try and analyze that data. And he made Kepler promise that he would try and make the data fit his model, his Tychonic model. And we actually have Kepler's works, and we can see that he tried for years to make this model work, and it just wouldn't work. Tycho's measurements were so good that they were going to not work with the Copernican model and not work with the geocentric model. Both of those were in disagreement with these very accurate measurements that Tycho had come up with. So he could get close. So if you think about how big the moon is, he could get accurate predictions of the planets to within about a third or a quarter, I guess closer to a quarter, of the size of the moon. So certainly what constellation is in, but you know, think about your finger away from your eye and then divide it into force. He could accurately predict the positions of the planets to that degree of accuracy. But Tycho had measured him more accurate than that, maybe 10 times more accurate than that. And so it wasn't working. And so there is a big period of time where all of these tribulations, as Kepler tries to do every imaginable thing to make this to make the system actually reproduce the motions of Mars. And he's finally led, really very much against his will, to the kind of crazy idea that it's not circles. That the motions of the planets are not parts of circles. He actually started out using ellipses because they approximated circles within circles. They would approximate this epicycle system a little bit simpler than the epicycles did. But then he found that his approximate version worked better than any combination of circles. So that turned out to be his first law. The motions of the planets are not pieces of circles. They're actually ellipses. And if we look at the picture that he comes up with, so first of all, let me remind you about what the old-fashioned picture was. So this thing isn't exactly a circle. Here's the center. The Earth is off center, and there's this point called an equant. What he's going to come up with is going to sound very similar to that with an ellipse, but it's just slightly different. So instead of having the Earth and an equant, we're going to have two focal points. And the way you construct an ellipse is by taking a loop of string and attaching it to these two focal points and just letting the string go around and around. So you know that a circle is the collection of points that are equidistant from a point. An ellipse is the set of points where the total distance, focus to point to focus, is the same distance. Okay, so we again have two sorts of spots. But instead of having exactly a circle, we have a squash circle, which is what an ellipse is. Okay. And you remember the way the old system worked. When we were close to the Earth, we were moving fast, perigee. And when we were far from the Earth, we were moving slow, apogee. And he needs something like that to work, or else it just won't match the... Remember that this thing works pretty well, so his system also has to have the same general property. But this whole idea of equal motion about an equant, that's dead out. I mean, Copernicus wasn't believing in equants. So he has to have some way of working out the timing of the planetary motion about what he now thinks isn't a circle, is instead an ellipse. And I think the measure of how hard he worked is what he finally came up with. It's a absolutely kind of crazy idea, I think. So what he said is, so I'm now switching to a heliocentric point of view. If the sun is at a focus, we can talk about the area that's swept out by a planet, say over a month, as it goes from A prime to B prime. Right? So we have this thing that's kind of like a triangle or a sector. Calculate the area of that. And then I claim that over the same period of time, the same area is going to be swept out. So as a result, since this triangle is very tall, its base has to be very small, which means that the planet has to be moving fewer miles per hour. Here we have a very low altitude, so we have to have a big base, which means that the planet has to be moving fast.
Okay, but this model is an exaggeration of what you've done.
Say again?
This model right here is an exaggeration of what you thought it looked like in order to illustrate the planet. You didn't actually think that the planet's got that close to the sun.
Correct, yeah. So this is the ellipses that are actually present for the planets, which he worked out, are all very close to being circles. And they're so close to being circles that you basically can't tell them apart from circles. Let's see what we got here. So the numerical way we have of talking about squashness is called the eccentricity. And so here's a perfect circle, which has eccentricity 0. No squashness. Here's the eccentricity of the, here's the planet Mars. And I think when you look at those things, boy, that sure looks like a circle. It doesn't look like the sun is at the center of the circle. It looks like it's off center, right? But that's the equant effect. If we look in detail, if I actually put both of them up here simultaneously, you can see that it is very slightly squashed. But boy, it's a small effect. So you'd never notice that if you didn't have these supremely accurate observations that Tycho had done. So the equant is a very good approximation. But to tell the difference between a circle and an ellipse, you really need extraordinarily good observations. So the I can't say the most eccentric planet. What Pluto's orbit is this. And boy, that still looks an awful lot like a circle with just the sun off center at the focus. If we have things like comets, they have pretty big eccentricity. So this is Halley's Comet. And now you can see, boy, it sure does look a whole lot like the pictures that we were showing you a second ago. So to excellent approximation, every planet's orbit looks like a circle just with the sun placed in an off-center spot. Okay. So Kepler's first law is that the orbits of planets are actually ellipses, and ellipses have some vocabulary that we want to learn about. So here's my approximation as an ellipse. The big diameter, that's called the major axis. And quite naturally, the small diameter is going to be the minor axis. Now remember that the ellipse is generated by two focuses, two foci. One of them is going to be the sun, and the other is going to be empty. There's nothing special going on here. So this is, of course, the center of the ellipse. The sun is not at the center of the ellipse. It's at a focus. Let's call this distance x that the sun is off center. So if we take the distance that it's off center and we divide it by half the major axis, which is called the semi-major axis, semi meaning half. So a semi-major axis is kind of like the big radius. So if we take x and divide it by a semi-major axis, which is usually denoted by A, that's what the eccentricity is. So if the two focuses are very close to the center, the eccentricity is very close to zero, and we have something that's very much like a circle. If the eccentricity is equal to zero, then it's like the two pinpoints being at the same point, and we will get exactly a circle. The biggest possible eccentricity would occur if the focus was way out here at the edge, right? So we could have an eccentricity of one. Yeah, so at that point, the ellipse is going to collapse. So if we literally have an eccentricity of one, it's going to be a line. And of course, if it's 0.99999, that line is going to be have a little bit of thickness above and a little bit of thickness below. And there are cometary orbits that are like three nines. So they get very, very flat. Okay. So we've got semi-major axis and eccentricity. Those are the ways we're going to be talking about ellipses. Squashed ellipses have an eccentricity of one. Exactly circular ellipses have an eccentricity of zero. When you think semi-major axis, you should think big radius. But notice that the semi-major axis is not the distance between where the planet is and the sun, right? Because it's a distance to an imaginary point at which there's nothing special, the center of the ellipse. The sun is off center.
If you were to superimpose all the planes in orbit, all the planets, would they be the same planet?
So the planets, so the kind of jumping ahead, remember we've said that the planets are all generally speaking pretty close to the ecliptic?
Yeah.
So that's because all the planes of these orbits are pretty much the same. They're not exactly the same, or the planets would all be exactly on the ecliptic. They are up and down a few degrees.
Okay.
And the biggest exception is Pluto, which is, I think, maybe like 25 degrees tilted. One of the reasons we don't like Pluto as a planet is because of the oddities of its orbit. The next biggest one that's off is Mercury. And the giant planets are very close to zero, to having zero inclination. More questions? Okay, so we've got Kepler's first law, Kepler's second law. How about Kepler's third law, since that's what's listed on that sheet? So we're kind of looking for signs that we're on the right track, and it had been known for a long time, of course, that the planets take different times to go around the celestial sphere, for example. Saturn taking the longest, then Jupiter, then Mars, and of course, on average, Mercury and Venus are exactly keeping up with the Sun. So what Kepler was able to find is a systematic pattern between the distance these planets were from the Sun, their semi-major axis, actually, not the distance is constantly changing. And the time it takes to go around. And it's kind of a funny law, Kepler's third law. And that law is that if you take the semi-major axis and cube it, so this is the semi-major axis in a unit that is the astronomical unit, the distance that the Earth is from the Sun, cube that, you're going to get exactly the same thing as the time it takes to go around. It's usually called the period in years squared. Okay, so Pluto has a semi-major axis of 40 AU. It's 40 times further from the Sun than the Earth is. And so we could figure out how long it takes for Pluto to go around by taking 40 and cubing it, and then taking the square root of it. So if you work out what this law means, so obviously Pluto is going to take longer to go around because it's got a bigger path to go around. But if we had that sort of situation that every planet had the same miles per hour, then you would have a relationship where the period and the semi-major axis were in proportion, as opposed to this funny three halves law. So what this law is saying is not only is Pluto taking a long time to go around because it's distant, but also because it's going fewer miles per hour. Okay, so the closer in planets are going more miles per hour on a shorter orbit, and that's why they have particularly short periods. And the way that works out is this funny cubed squared rule.
So the size of the planet has an impact on how fast, how quickly it orbits the asteroid, how close
to the orbit. So that's I should pay you for these questions. So that's an excellent point. So the fact that there is such a relationship, and we know the planets all have different sizes and different masses, tells you that the time it takes to go around doesn't depend on the mass. And that probably didn't occur to Kepler because people really had no idea about what the nature of planets were. I mean, it wasn't clear they were objects in the normal sense of the word, right? Aristotle would have told them they're made out of totally different stuff. But if you think about it, there's another circumstance where Aristotle would have said things with different masses would have different behaviors, and in fact, they don't. So Aristotle said, literally, if you take a heavy object it's going to be retarded, right? It's going to be harder to push around. And so if you were to drop a heavy object and a light object, the light object would fall faster because it would have less resistance to the motion.
So,
yeah, but it works. So I think you already know what I'm aiming at. I'm aiming at this perhaps experiment that never occurred that Galileo is usually credited with. So supposedly, Galileo went to the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and he took a heavy object and a light object, and he dropped them. And instead of, as Aristotle said, the heavy object taking longer to hit the ground, they fell pretty much together and hit the ground at pretty much the same time. So we'll find fancier ways of doing this next time. But if I take this rock, which weighs way more than this dime, and I drop them, it stuck to my fingers. I proved nothing. I wonder how I can do that so it won't stick. There. So they differ by more than a factor of 10 in terms of mass, but you can see that they fell more or less together. So one of the reasons we don't think that Galileo literally did this experiment is it doesn't work real well if you are something as high as the Leaning Tower of Pisa because of air resistance. Yeah, there's a nice inclined plane back here, but. So this inclined plane is actually made exactly to the specifications that Galileo writes. Galileo writes about doing the following experiment. So it's hard to see this thing fall because it all happens kind of faster than you can react. I mean, you can see it's going from there to there, but exactly how that occurs is less than perfectly obvious, right? So today we could take time-lapse photography and we could see exactly how that's moving. But Galileo, of course, didn't have that available. So he said, let's slow down this motion by using an inclined plane. So you can see that it starts out slow and it's picking up speed. How exactly, what rate is it picking up speed? Almost as fast as I can, I guess. What is the relationship that gives that picking up of speed effect? Does it depend on the mass of this thing? And it turns out it doesn't. So actually what we think Galileo did, even this is moderately fast to observe, if you have water clocks, which is what he had available. So actually Galileo's father was a musician, and we think that he was good at tapping out time. So we think that what he actually did is make little nick marks. So when this thing passed a nick mark, it would make a little click, and then he spaced those marks so that it was in regular time. And then he could see how far things went at different times. And what he found is there's kind of a nice relationship between how far the ball goes and what time it is. And it turns out that relationship is a square. So that if in 1 second it goes 1 foot, in 2 seconds it'll go 4 feet, in 3 seconds it'll go 9 feet, etc.
That whole theory doesn't make sense to me because the theory of gravitation says that two objects with more mass will have a greater attraction to each other than two objects with less mass. And I feel like the reason that we're not noticing a difference is because we're dealing with two objects that, in proportion to the size of the Earth, are pretty much the same size, even if one's, you know, three times bigger than the other. We're dealing on a small scale.
So what you say makes perfect sense, but it doesn't work out that way. So we have to explain that because what you said is certainly the obvious conclusion. And it's the conclusion that Aristotle came up with, right? It makes perfectly good sense. The force of gravity on a Mack truck is certainly a whole lot more than the force of gravity on this ball. And you would think that if the force is that hugely different, the motion would be different.
Yeah, because the attraction is stronger, right?
For sure the attraction's stronger. That's what weight is. It's that gravitational force. And for sure, a Mack truck weighs more than this ball.
Yeah.
And you would think that different forces would give different results.
So
if you were to take out air or any matter that would create resistance, and you were to drop the truck from a mile and the ball, they would land at the same time.
Yes. So famously, the Apollo astronauts, this has been in physics books forever, that if you take a feather and a ball and drop them, they would fall the same if there weren't any air. So it's hard to do on Earth, but they could do it just fine on the moon. So there's nice video of this feather and this ball dropping at exactly the same rate. So one hint that's going on here, though, is, as you said earlier, it's contained in Kepler's law. We know that Jupiter is way different from Mercury. But there's one law that's judging how they go that doesn't seem to care about their mass. So it must be that even though mass obviously has a huge role to play, somehow that role is disappearing. And this is way ahead of what we'll ever talk about, but let me just comment that the fact that mass does somehow not matter, even though it seems like it should matter, that played a huge role for Einstein in coming up with his theory of general relativity. But we've got other people to go, we got centuries to go through before we get to Einstein. Okay, but let's write that down. So surprising result, mass doesn't matter. And it's because all of these motions are so fast, it's hard to demonstrate them. And I will have some demos next time that I hope will convince you better than my dropping the thing. But before we go into those directions, let's kind of take a look at some computational versions of all of this. So these, obviously you could make these animations work any way you want, but here we have an object that has a mass of 15 kilograms, and I throw it, and it reaches a height of basically 14 and a half meters, right? It goes up and comes down. If I radically change the mass and throw it up, it goes to exactly the same spot. Obviously, gravity is pulling that 15 kilogram object way harder than it's pulling the 1 kilogram object, but the motion is the same. Somehow or other, mass cancels out. And kind of the first hint of this is Galileo dropping the two objects off the side of the building. Somehow or other, mass doesn't matter when we have gravity being present. It's not at all obvious why that's the case, but it is the case.
Does that guy, you know, obviously have a different force when he's throwing the ball up or
not? Yes. So he just holding it, of course, a 15 kilogram thing is going to take more, let alone throwing it up. So he definitely has to push harder in order to make it reach that same height. But once gravity alone is taking action, once it's, you know, running on its own, the mass doesn't matter. Heavy objects, light objects, they're going to fall together, they're going to move together. If they start the same, they're going to end the same. So if you push them up with the same amount of force, that's a different story, right? Because even just to hold those two objects is going to take different forces, let alone to move them. So if I throw them up with different forces, they will have different velocities and they'll have different motions. But if in fact I throw them with the same velocity, if I give them to gravity with the same speed, then their paths will be the same. So this is kind of half of what Galileo did. The other half of what Galileo did is he claimed to have invented the telescope. So here we have the invention of the telescope, which we think actually occurred in Holland. Galileo heard about it and he made his own version of it just based on the description. And he tried to sell it to the local nobles as kind of his own device. And actually, it worked pretty well. But more importantly, he was the first guy who used the telescope to look at the sky. And as soon as he started looking at the sky through a telescope, magnifying the view, there were lots of things that were immediately obvious that were not according to Aristotle. And so here we start to have the first good evidence that Copernicus is more or less right and Aristotle is definitely wrong. And the evidence for this comes from the phases of Venus, or at least the best evidence. We'll talk about more evidence next time too. So if you think about the point of view of the old system, Okay, one last try. There we go. So Venus is always going to be more or less in front of the sun, and so Venus is always going to have a more or less crescent phase. Right? On the other hand, if we have the normal system of the universe where Venus is sometimes on the far side of the solar system and sometimes on the near side of the solar system, then we're going to have Venus showing all the phases. Right? So this is a pretty small view, but if Venus is here, then we're going to be seeing a new Venus and a crescent Venus. When Venus is on the other side of the solar system, we're going to be seeing a full Venus. Now, to your naked eye, Venus just looks like a dot. But if you look at it through a telescope, you can see phases of Venus just like you can see phases of the moon. And what Galileo saw was this. We had nearly full phases. Of course, you can't see Venus when it's in the exact same direction as the sun. And then as it reapproached the sun, we get crescent Venuses, and so it goes. So Venus, at least, had to be going around the sun. In the old geocentric model, Venus was always between the Earth and the sun, so it would always show crescent phases. If it's showing both crescent and full, then it has to be in front of the sun and behind the sun. And that's only possible if it's going around the sun. So that doesn't rule out the Tychonic system, Tycho system, you remember, because that still had the that same sort of behavior. Okay, so the plan at this point is to use the last 5 minutes of class for a field trip. So you're not coming back unless you really want to. So pack up your stuff. And what we're going to do is walk out the front door. And we're going to make moons. At least earlier I saw a moon. Sometimes during class the world fools me and I won't be able to see the moon, in which case the field trip is for naught. But I'm hoping it's still bright sunshine out there and you can take one of these moons and compare it to the moon that's actually there. So I'll meet you at the front of Peter Engel. Supposed to be a whole line of ducks behind me. Are there yet? Yes. Ah! It's a wash. Nothing to see. Goodbye. See you Monday.
Thank you.
Field trip to no place. Cloudy sky. Nothing to see. Cloudy. See you Monday. Field trip to no place. It's cloudy.
Of course.
See you Monday, it's cloudy. Didn't work. Sometimes the magic works.